Welcome everyone. This is Beverly Tomasian and I'm excited to be presenting our last boot camp in the series. Boot camp number 8, which is all about behavior change and healthy coping. So this is really an important part of providing diabetes education. It's something that we do a lot intuitively as we meet with patients, and it's a topic that's brought up again and again in the exam. So as part of the exam, we definitely need to be familiar with these concepts, and I would say most importantly, we want to be familiar with these concepts as we sit across from our patients who are living with diabetes, struggling with diabetes, frustrated with their diabetes, and be present with them in all of the stages they go through in managing their diabetes. And so the goal of this course is to not only help prepare you for the exam, but give you some real helpful tools that you can apply in your clinical setting. And this is the outline from the CDE exam handbook. And again, every class I try and focus and highlight for you what they expect from you on this exam relevant to each of the topics I'm providing. So we need to be able to assess learning and self-care behaviors, and you can take a look at that. It includes learning style, readiness, barriers, physical capabilities and limitations, and readiness. We need to assess medical, health, psychosocial, and economic status. This is so important. This is 40 of the test questions right here, and there's another 20 under assessment of diabetes and prediabetes in addition to that. So there's 60 altogether on this topic. We need to know about their health history, and then substance use, developmental transitions, mental health issues, barriers to self-care. Look at cultural, spiritual, psychosocial, physical, economic. This is all part of what we do. So it's not, you know, just the diabetes pathology and medications and food. We have to assess everything that's rolling around the patient, because they come in not with just their diabetes, but with their whole life experience and current situation. We're going to teach regarding principles of care. We're going to look at, this is more looking at the risk factors and pathophysiology, but if we come down here, living with diabetes and prediabetes, psychosocial adaptations, problems, depression, role and responsibilities of care, decision making, safety, hygiene, and social and financial issues. So you can see these components appear in the assessment piece and also the intervention, teaching counsel regarding principles of care. So it's woven in throughout the exam in a really profound way, and for good reason. People don't improve their health of their diabetes if they don't change their behavior. So behavior change is really the crux of what we do as educators. And we develop a lot of expertise in supporting people making those changes. Some big changes and a lot of small changes, I would say. And we help people kind of reframe their diabetes, see it a little bit differently. We offer them resources. We offer them hope. We offer support. And so this is really central to the philosophy of diabetes education. So during this program, we are going to talk about the chronic care model. This has been appearing in the exam, so I want to spend some time talking about the macro view or the big view of diabetes, and then we'll drill down and look at coping and the patient assessment. We'll list psychosocial, emotional, and life barriers to diabetes care. We'll discuss strategies to help patients with individualized coping skills, again, that word. So one coping skill may work for someone, and another person, they're like, that's not going to work for me. And we're going to describe behavior change models and approaches. So you see the word models, and you want to run the other way. So models can be dry, but we're going to be talking about models because they come up on the exam. And also, we'll try and make the models come alive for you, because models are based in research and they're based on application. And so we'll see if we can apply some of these models with our patient situations. So now I'm going to take the big approach and talk about providing diabetes care. And seriously, we know we're not doing a very good job of providing diabetes care in the United States. Diabetes is a chronic illness and it needs a well-organized health system to deliver the best care possible. We're pretty fragmented right now in the United States. There are some HMOs doing a great job of chronic disease management, And I had one of my providers in my community. He said, I'm going to start a chronic care model in my practice. And so he's doing more patient management, tracking outcomes. And it's really exciting. So this is kind of catching on. But let's talk about what that means. So to provide chronic care, so diabetes lasts a lifetime, we need to set up a successful delivery system. We need to think about the unique needs of the individual. So while we set up these systems, we still need to consider the individual. And since we know diabetes is primarily a self-managed condition, we have to make sure we're supporting self-care. And this is from the American Diabetes Association Standards of Care. And they say we need to change the care system and focus on the quality of care to be delivered. So really moving away from, just moving patients through, looking at, are we really providing a benefit for our patients? Are we improving outcomes? So optimal diabetes management requires an organized, systematic approach, a coordinated team of healthcare professionals working in an environment where patient-centered care, this is from the American Diabetes Association, patient-centered care, high-quality care is a priority. We need to change the care system. This is evidence-based. We know that interdisciplinary teams providing intensive diabetes management is a strategy that works best. We know what works. It's like a lot of times diabetes care is provided in silos. There's an endocrinologist, there's a dietitian, there's an educator, there's a pharmacist, there's a social worker, and we're not able to integrate as a team. And so we know that if we can share information, if we're located in a nearby physical space, if we can share health records and activate and educate patients, look at removing financial barriers, and look at public policy changes. So this is really great. And the American Diabetes Association says, what about a soda tax? And we're working on that really hard in California right now. And we're also working on labeling our sodas with a warning, can cause diabetes and obesity. And then looking at community resources, low-cost dental care, big issue. Dental care and diabetes go together, but dental care can be really expensive. So the main concepts of diabetes care that works, keep it patient-centered. Customize standard goals based on the assessment. You all know this, but this is what the exam is all about. Look at diabetes across the lifespan. We are getting diabetes earlier and living longer. We need to be familiar with diabetes across the care continuum, and we need to promote coordinated care across the person's life. Advocacy, big part of what we do. Health educators, healthcare professionals, anybody working in diabetes, we want to be a voice that's heard in legislation, in our communities, in Congress, with our senators, whoever will listen to us. Because there's a lot of health disparities in America, and we need to kind of look at our environment and make some changes to move from an obesogenic environment to an environment that promotes health. And we can be a big part of that. Here's a major barriers to healthcare I was alluding to. Fragmented, lack of electronic information sharing, two people doing the same job when we could be using our resources more wisely. It's not designed to deliver chronic care. So this is a solution that the model that we're promoting right now, the chronic care model, to help improve this system. And there are six core elements for optimal diabetes care. So proactive versus reactive. So instead of waiting till somebody's in a diabetes crisis and they're in DKA or HHS because they can't afford their medication, to say, can we be proactive and anticipate this problem's going to happen and do something to prevent it in some way? Supporting self-management. How the patient is a primary person managing their diabetes. How can we support them? And then decision support, helping providers make the best clinical decision based on evidence. We have plenty of evidence now that, what patients with diabetes the care they should be receiving, the interventions that work. Let's bring that to practice. Having the ability to track patients and patient populations to see how we're doing as far as outcomes, and then again looking at the big picture. Community policies and resources and health systems that create a culture of quality. So this is a chronic care model. I would put a star by that and be familiar with the six tenets of that. We need to redefine our roles and build teams. So we need to say, okay, where are the strengths of our team members and how do we pull those strengths out? And I really think part of this is really engaging community health workers. So people in the community that can help influence or change the environment or talk to their neighbors or, you know, bring diabetes to a real personal level. Collaborative multidisciplinary teams are best suited to provide diabetes care and support and help patients succeed. We all know that. So moving on to each unique individual is Oscar Wilde. I love this quote, so I've brought it up a few times. Be yourself. Everyone else is already taken. And so just like, you know, we suggest for ourselves, our patients bring their own unique personality to the situation, and they bring their life learning, they bring their current social situation, they bring psychosocial issues, emotional issues. All of that is brought to the moment when we meet with them. And so how do we help assess what's working for them and what's not working and move them to the best possible place of health within our abilities? And then if we can't help them, do we have resources that we can refer them out to? That's a big part of the exam too, because we clearly recognize that we can't do it all. We're diabetes educators. We have a certain scope of practice. But if something is trending outside of our scope or our comfort level, we also are obligated to know where to refer patients. So that's part of what we do. We look up these resources that we can reach out to help our patients get the best care possible. So how to improve the chronic care model, optimize provider and team behavior. We want to make sure that patients aren't lost, you know, that we follow up with them and intensify lifestyle if their blood sugars aren't at target. Help them set goals, use evidence-based guidelines, and incorporate care management teams. And then we want to make sure to address the literal and cultural barriers. So, as you know, many people that we work with are illiterate in different ways. So there's something called numeral literacy. That means you can understand numbers. So if a person doesn't understand how to recognize numbers, to them, 130 could look the same as 310 or 013. The numbers don't hold meaning for them. And so one way we could evaluate this is say, okay, let's take a look at your blood sugar, check their blood sugar, and say, tell me what number you see, and then what does that mean to you? So that's one way we can assess numeral literacy. Or have them, you know, read a piece of paper. Like sometimes I'll say, these are the goals for your blood sugars from the American Diabetes Association. What does it say right here? And then that's another way just to assess literacy. Have them reading a fragment of a sentence or a part of or a short sentence to see what they're able to do. But there's also health literacy. They don't know how to use a health system. I've had so many patients who couldn't afford their prescriptions. So what they do is they don't refill them. And they don't know who to reach out to. So making sure that our patients understand if they don't understand how to work the health system, that we identify that and help them get the care they need. And then functional. Can they use reading and writing and computation adequate for everyday situations? I had a friend, he could read and write, but he couldn't use a phone book. He didn't understand how to alphabetize. So that would be functional literacy. Everybody comes with their own strengths and their barriers, and we want to be able to assess that in a kind way and determine if they need some more assistance. So no matter what our patients appear or what they look like, we want to make sure that they can read. And so what are some strategies? And generally we just go direct, you know, can you read? We can ask them that. Or we can say, is this blood sugar in target? And when they look at their blood sugar number, and you could see, do they understand numbers? Do they understand ranges? Can they read? And then this is a really great question too. If your blood sugar is whatever, what would you do? So do they understand the significance of those numbers and know what action to take? Can you read this back to me? I want to tell you what I do a lot of times is, together the patient and I will set goals, and I have a little sheet that I write their goals with them, and then I say, okay, let's just wrap up and read back to me what we've discussed. It's a really good way to assess their ability to, A, read my writing, which is really bad, but B, to see if they can read and if it makes sense to them. A return demonstration, another way to assess literacy. Can they, you know, use a meter? Can they drop insulin? Can they identify the numbers on the insulin syringe? So there's all kinds of way we can assess these different literacy issues besides formalized tests. Many times we don't have time to do formalized tests, so we can do these other means of evaluating their literacy level. Okay, so which of the poll, our first poll of the day, which of the following strategies are best used when someone has low literacy skills? Is it A, speak slowly and clearly? Is it B, underline key points on educational materials? Is it C, direct the teaching to the support person and encourage reinforcement? Or B, be concrete and focus on problem solving? Which is the right answer? Let me launch this. All right, thanks for voting, everybody. I'll take a few more seconds. So if you're wondering, are they going to have questions on the test about literacy? Absolutely. Okay, I'm going to close this poll. And if you didn't vote, that's okay. We're just kind of getting a feel for what answers you're choosing. So let me share this with you, because I think this is a really good question to spend some time on. So just to be really clear, low literacy doesn't mean the person is slow. It doesn't mean they're not very bright. There's a lot of people who are low literate who are very bright. They just didn't have the opportunity to learn how to read. Or they, you know, they didn't weren't able to stay in school, or something happened. So this is very important that we recognize this. So A, 18% of you said speak slowly and clearly. So that would be the case if the English was their second language. So for people with English as a second language, I notice I really slow down and I use my best enunciation and I try not to use complex sentence structures. But this is not the situation. This patient has low literacy skills. So A is the wrong answer. They're not, when you speak slowly and clearly, it makes a person feel like you think they're not that bright. That's not the case at all. They might be just as bright as you and I. Or maybe brighter, you never know. Okay, B, nobody chose that, so I'm not gonna talk about that. C, direct the teaching to the support person and encourage reinforcement. Okay, again, we've gotta direct our teaching right to the person in front of us. The person might feel a little bit offended if just because they can't read, we turn to their partner and focus on sharing with their partner. This person can understand what we're saying. They just maybe can't read. So this is a really important distinction. A lot of patients who I work with who are low literate or can't write, I repeat key concepts several times, and they have a really good ability to memorize because that's their backup if they can't read. They memorize a lot of stuff. So D is the right answer. Concrete, be concrete and focus on problem solving. Yay. Okay, so D is the best answer. If you didn't choose that, just, you know, this is a kind of a tricky question, but we just want to be familiar with strategies to address low literacy. And if you don't have the Art and Science book, they do have some really good information on low literacy. But I have a great slide on it too. Be concrete, be sensitive to word usage. We don't want to use, you know, really, I just want to say something. I generally try to speak in English when I talk to my patients, and I really avoid medical jargon. And as a matter of fact, even when I'm teaching classes to healthcare professionals, I really limit my medical jargon. I mean, I use it, but I try and just speak in regular language, everyday language. It works better. We want to stick to a few key messages. Be patient. We might need to use teaching aids. Problem solving, they love that, and maybe we can all adults love problem solving, not just low literate, you know, patients. But everybody, like, well, what do I do if? That's how problem solving's the question they're going to ask. And then maybe we use more video teaching, or, you know, YouTube has a lot of great videos out there. And then we're going to engage a support person, but they're not going to be the focus of our education. So for a lot of times when treatment goals are met, patients might be called non-compliant. And I don't believe in non-compliance. The book and the test don't assume anyone is non-compliant. What we assume is if people aren't doing the care that they need to stay healthy, is that there's barriers, barriers, barriers. So look for barriers. If somebody is not able to reach their targets, find out. Tell me I often ask this question very straightforward. Tell me what's stopping you from exercising. Tell me what's stopping you from checking your blood sugars. It's non-judgmental. It's just totally straightforward. And I get a lot of great responses from that. And you know what? They're legitimate. Maybe it's literacy. Maybe they're distressed or depressed. You know, they just can't, they don't even have the energy to make food, let alone check their blood sugar. They can't afford it. Or, oh my gosh, I'm so busy. I work all day. I come home. I've got my family. I've got babies. There's a lot of good reasons people can't do stuff. Are we really keeping their cultural issues in mind when we're providing education? And then we want to make sure we reach out to our colleagues for assistance if the patient's struggling with finances, insurance coverage. I just had a gal who is partially blind, can't drive anymore, and she had no idea about the resources in our community to help her get around. So I provided that for her. It's a gift. We can give patients that gift. And then tell me about how you're taking your medication. I want to tell you something really important. I've met with so many people just yesterday in my clinic, and they're given medication and not often given instructions on how to use it. And so they use a lot of creativity. I had a person who was adjusting his Lantus based on how much food he ate and what his blood sugars were. He was adjusting his basal insulin. Nobody instructed him on how to use Lantus therapy. So that's not non-compliant. That's not getting enough information. So I think a lot of times we misinterpret that. We want to really do a great assessment. And when we're doing a great assessment, I notice one thing that happens. We're quiet. I know when I'm really quiet and intent, I'm doing my best assessment and really hearing the patient. We want to look at the psychological and social situation. And that, you might think, hey, that's not what we do, but yeah, it really is, because if their home life is crazy, if they're in a chaotic situation, diabetes takes a low priority. So we need to work the diabetes into their life situation. So we're going to look at screening for what's happening. We're going to look at their attitudes, their expectations, what's their mood and affect, resources, and psychiatric history. So part of when we assess our patients, stress response and coping strategies are based on what the patient brings to the table. What are their beliefs about health? What are their perceptions about diabetes? What are their cultural traditions? What's their family like? What's their employment and their religious beliefs? And what about their personal factors and psychosocial? So all of that comes into our assessment. And I love this series of questions. This was put together by Diane Pearson, a wonderful friend and colleague and diabetes expert in the area of behavior change. And here's some questions. If you're new to this and it doesn't come intuitive to you, here are questions you can ask your patients. Is this important to you? What do you think of your diabetes? So when you say, what is this, if is this important to you, what if they're not checking their blood sugars? You might want to ask, does this feel like it's important or valuable to you, checking your blood sugars? Find out. What's the best way to communicate with you? Do you like emailing, or should I phone you, or do you like person, you know, one-on-one? What are your goals? So you can see what's underlined is we're focusing on other. We're not focusing on us. What are your personal beliefs and values? We may not ask it in this way. These are just ways to really do an in-depth assessment. So you can word these in your ways that feel most comfortable to you. But my favorite question is, how are you feeling about all of this? Because if they're overwhelmed, I had a patient I was with the other day, and I spent 2 hours with them because we needed a lot of time. And halfway through the 2 hours, I go, are you feeling overwhelmed? And they go, no, we're loving this. We're sponges. We're soaking it up. So just checking in with them like that is a great strategy, because you can usually tell when people are overwhelmed. They get the glassy-eyed. But sometimes I just ask them, and they appreciate the question. The other thing we want to assess is developmental age and stage. Where are they in the lifespan, finances, environment, all that. And then what about their physical capabilities and limits? Can they walk great, or are they unsteady on their feet? I have so many patients. Well, I work with a lot of older clients who are really, their gait is unsteady. And can we support them, you know, get them hooked up with PT or OT for an evaluation so they're safe? How's her vision? I had a gal who came in to see me, and she only had 20/60 vision in one of her eyes and blind in the other. How does that impact her daily life? Can she do diabetes safely? Hearing, diabetes, people often have diminished hearing as a result of diabetes and neuropathy in their ears. So we're going to evaluate all of this. And what about substance abuse? You know, are they using drugs? Are they drinking? Are they smoking? And then who is your support system? So all of these are part of our assessment and gathering data to help them move toward the best diabetes self-management they can attain. And so here's a social support assessment tool. Who helps you with your diabetes? And what kind of support do they give you? Who makes it harder? I just had a gal in my class say, you know what, I love my husband, but he always, you know, brings home chocolate for me, and I'm trying to eat healthier. And then this is, what would you like in support for day to day? So a lot of times I'll help patients identify, you know, let me know, tell me how your husband could support you with your diabetes. You know, share it with me. And then we work on her sharing it with her husband. How could she word that in a way that helps her husband understand her needs and still engages him in supporting her and not being offended? What can I do to help you get the support you want? These are great questions, social support assessment questions. So these are just kind of things you could think of, but you can see, again, the focus is on the patient. We're not saying, oh, I'm going to take care of this, or I'm going to take care of you. No, because we ultimately understand the patient needs to do this. We coach, we support, we affirm. So there's different types of social support. We give patients a lot of this emotional support. And it sounds like, ah, that sounds really hard. You know, I hear that you're struggling with that. So that's also called affirmational support. So we do a lot of affirmation, emotional support. And for patients, this type of support is perceived as the most important. And so I think of diabetes education as a combination of giving our patients love and honest feedback. Those two put together. So it's a very kind of loving profession because we're listening intently to people's stories in a non-judgmental fashion, which is kind of a definition of love, listening and not judging. But then we're also giving honest feedback. That seems like it's not really working for you. Is there anything that you could think of to do differently so you could succeed? Informational support, we do this a lot. Problem solving, you know, a handout with resources that they can use. We're going to help them learn how to use their meter, and that's also kind of goes in with instrumental support. So making sure they can use their syringes, maybe sharing apps with them, making sure they have access to the goods and services they need. So social support can be virtual or live. It can be a phone call. So lots of times I'll call my patients once a week when they're starting out. Hey, how are you doing? I'm always going to ask them, how are you doing? First, how are things going? And then I'm going to say, how are your blood sugars? But we always want to check in with them from a human perspective first, because sometimes, you know, I've read in studies that people with diabetes feel like they're just their blood sugars to providers. No, of course they're way more than that, but we're busy. So it just takes a second to check in with them and then move on to the blood sugars. Okay, we also want to assess learning style. So I had a patient fill out a questionnaire about her, you know, how do you like to learn? And she's like, read the questionnaire. It says how I like to learn best. I'm like, okay. And she wanted to learn by computer. She goes, I like computer. I can't really drive. And so it's a really great way for me to learn online learning. And she was 70. So you might be surprised by what you find. Most of us are sensors to a degree. We want to be involved. We want to problem solve. We want to touch it. We want to work through it. We like demonstrations. And some of us like the feeling aspect. We want to listen and discuss and go through things. But some of us are thinkers. I can always tell my thinkers in class because they're leafing through the handout when other people are talking about feelings. You've seen that. And the feeling people are just like talking about the emotional aspects. But you know, all of us have, of course, different degrees of this. So all of our patients bring some of this, and some just have a desire to learn in one or the other way. And many of us are kinesthetic. We like to move. We like to move and learn, and we want to be actively involved. So everybody's a little bit different. So when we think about routine mental health screening, we think about depression. 20 to 25% of people with diabetes are depressed. That's high. So there seems to be some relationship between hyperglycemia and depression. We haven't figured out those links clearly yet, but it seems that there's some interlinkage here. Depression increases the risk of heart attack and death. And really high priority to screen and treat for those over 65. A lot of older clients struggle with depression that can lead to isolation and, really just not being able to do very good self-care. So you really need to provide a collaborative care approach to treat depression. So there's depression, but there's also diabetes related to stress, which is a little bit different. We'll talk about that. So depression, we'll talk about the definition, is more severe and long-lasting, where diabetes related to stress is more a reflection of the current situation, and we can support patients through that. There's also anxiety, so we're looking for depression, distress, anxiety, eating disorders, and cognitive impairment. So let's do another poll question. Which of the following statements by a patient reflects that they are depressed? A. I used to love gardening. Now I don't even care if my garden is overrun by weeds. B. Yeah, I feel sad I have diabetes. C. Some mornings it's just hard to check my blood sugars. D. I am so tired of everyone telling me how to eat. So which one of these signifies depression? Okay, thanks for voting, everyone. And if you didn't have a chance, there is a really good handout I provided for you. It's the PHQ Depression Screening Score, a screening tool, and it has a lot of great questions about evaluating for depression. I put that in your resources. But let me go ahead and close this and share your results. So 91% of you chose the right answer. I used to love gardening, but now I don't even care if my garden is overrun by weeds. That is a strong sign, and it goes with depression is defined, one of the definitions. You lose interest in things that you used to love doing. That's kind of a hallmark of depression. And then some of you chose C. Some mornings it's just hard to check my blood sugar. So that's not really depression. That might be just kind of a little bit of distress associated with diabetes. But if you just said every morning it's a struggle to get out of bed, okay, that's more like depression. But it's hard to check my blood sugars, that's true for everybody. Generally nobody wants to poke their fingers. So A is the right answer. Good job, team. So depression. You all know who this gentleman is, Robin Williams, and so many people are struggling with depression, and I think if there's anything that comes out of, his suicide is increasing our conversation about depression and how we can reach out to people and maybe support them in a different direction. So depression is characterized by a depressed mood, loss of interest in activities usually found pleasurable, really hard concentrating, changes in their sleep, changes in appetite, and if you can imagine, you're barely getting through the day. Self-care can be virtually impossible. So they might come in, they might not have very good hygiene, they're not really taking care of themselves, they're not checking their blood sugars, and maybe their blood sugars are high. Certainly when blood sugars are high, it can exacerbate depression, because when blood sugars are high, you feel tired, run down, you're going to the bathroom a lot, so you're not sleeping that well. And so it can intensify that feeling of distress and depression. Let's take a look at Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones is 67 years old, type 2 for 12 years with an unknown A1C. He is widowed and has a low-income job, close to layoff. So, the current economy, a lot of our patients are struggling financially. He's teetering on foreclosure of his home. What are some risk factors that may make coping difficult for Mr. Jones? So, we're thinking we want to see him and help him with his diabetes, but then we start hearing his story. Well, my wife just died, and I have a job, but I'm barely holding on, and my house is about to foreclose on me. I can't make the rent. So if you can imagine in that life situation, what number priority is his diabetes? It is not number one. He has to worry about a place to live and about getting enough money so his home isn't foreclosed. And so in this situation, you know, let's just say his A1C is 7.8. I'm not going to say, Mr. Jones, we've got to get that A1C less than 7. I'm going to say, you know what, given your whole life situation and all the barriers and stresses, I think a 7.8 is okay for now, because we have in the back of our mind A1C less than 8% for older patients, you know, who've had it for a while is okay. And then as you start working through this life situation, let's meet and then we'll see if we can't make some adjustments. So at this point, I'm not going to say, well, you need to start exercising to help manage your stress. You need to, you know, I know you're a widow, but you really need to eat salads every day. We're going to really have to think about what's realistic for him and then make sure we set him up with some resources. That's going to be really important. To add to this, he helps take care of his elderly mother, and he tells you, I struggle with feeling blue. And he has a few drinks a day. Okay, so now we're getting more information. So as we're listening and we're non-judgmental, he's sharing more and more with us. So now we're kind of worried about, you know, alcoholism and getting burned out, being a caregiver. So are there pretty good chances Mr. Jones are depressed? Yeah, there's a pretty good chance. And a lot of people with depression do use alcohol to self-treat. And how could you find out? And so if you have a minute, if you can, to download and print out the PHQ-9 questionnaire. That means it's 9 questions. And it's a real easy form for patients to fill out. And if you don't have it in front of you, I just want to tell you it's a 0 to 3 rating score. And questions 2 or 3 indicate a problem if they give it a 2 or 3 response. And the questions say it's a Likert scale, 0 to 3. And if they choose 2 or 3, it means they're really struggling. But the questions are, do you have little interest or pleasure in doing things? 2, feeling down, depressed, or hopeless? 3, trouble falling or staying asleep or sleeping too much? 4, feeling tired or having little energy? And it goes on. There's 9 questions like that. And then the patients rate themselves, and then you can see there's a score that is, you can, you know, add up the total and do a score. And if there's more than 5 in the 3 to 4 section, we know that we're dealing with some serious depression. Even 2 to 4 means there's some other issues happening. 2 to 4 in the yes, you know, column. This is a good screening tool, and we can use this to get initial assessment of a patient. And what if they are depressed? Then we want to have resources available. And I love this thing, refer to therapy, list ready, to help them, because depression is treatable. So here's 2 questions we can use. Over the last 2 weeks, have you felt down, depressed, or hopeless? Or we could do the PHQ-9. And over the last 2 weeks, have you felt little pleasure in doing things? And if they say yes to both of those, then we know they're probably moving into depression, and we can do some more testing. And then the other thing is antidepressants work best when coupled with therapy, but they do take 2 to 8 weeks to work. And so we want to let our patients know, even if you start on antidepressants, it's going to take some time, so be patient. But depression isn't the only thing that can plague our patients. Also anxiety. I have a lot of patients come in to see me with anxiety. I had one gentleman who said, I don't want to go to sleep at night. I'm afraid of dying from hypoglycemia. And that's a realistic fear. We don't want to die from hypoglycemia, but his regimen really didn't set him up. Like, he wasn't on an intensive diabetes regimen that would cause severe hypoglycemia. So I would consider him as anxious, an exaggerated response to normal fears. He was hypervigilant. He would stay up till 3 o'clock and, you know, eat food to make sure his blood sugars wouldn't go too low. That's anxiety. And actually, how do I know he was anxious? Because his behavior, but he also told me, I have severe anxiety. And so for these patients, we have to approach this in a different way too. We don't want to overwhelm them with a lot of goals. They're already anxious enough. So you've got to keep it realistic for them. So how is anxiety defined? These symptoms must occur for you must have 5 symptoms for over 6 months. Restless, keyed up, fatigue, can't concentrate, irritability, muscle tension, sleep disturbances. definition of anxiety. So it's not just for a week, it's for 6 months. Diabetes causes fear, hypoglycemia, complications, living with a chronic condition. And what is the impact of anxiety? Well, when you're anxious, you release more stress hormones. Stress hormones cause more insulin resistance, and that makes your blood sugars go up. And when we're anxious and depressed, we're less able to care for ourselves, and so it can really be a barrier to self-care. Anxiety, we want to make sure we identify it, and we want to make sure that when we consider this patient's anxiety, we don't load a bunch of goals on them. We have to work within their framework for success. That's so important. Okay, anxiety. Let's keep going. Cognitive impairment. People with diabetes are more likely to have dementia. Dementia is associated with hyperglycemia and other causes, and Alzheimer's. Many patients with diabetes might struggle with Alzheimer's, and actually sometimes they call Alzheimer's type 3 diabetes, because in the brain, insulin acts as a neurotransmitter, and if you don't make enough insulin, you may not be neurotransmitting very successfully. And so we want to help patients keep at their best cognition possible, and we can achieve that by helping them keep active and engaged socially and physically. But if they're really struggling with cognition, we want to make sure that they get the resources they need. And look at this, achieving optimal blood glucose control is so important. I've had patients with a lot of issues with cognition, and as we got their blood sugars down, they were able to think more clearly. So that's important. And then engaging a pharmacist to look at drugs and their interactions. So a lot of patients, older patients, are on multiple drugs that might be contributing to lack of cognition or diminished cognition, and the statins have been implicated in that for some of our patients too. So involving the pharmacist to evaluate that is really critical. Poll question 3. A 47-year-old enters your office and says, "The doctor made me come here. I don't know why. I just have borderline diabetes." The patient's A1C is 8.7%. What is the most appropriate response? A. According to your A1C level, it looks like you have diabetes. B. We don't use the term borderline diabetes anymore. C. Let's just start with carb counting. Or D. I sense you are feeling frustrated. Let's see what you come up with. The best, most appropriate response. Thanks for voting, everyone. See, you guys are on fire. Just getting this question right. Great job. I put juicy answers in there too to lure you in, and nobody's getting lured in. You guys are outsmarting me. I'm going to close this and share with you. So you're right. So the last answer, D, I sense you are feeling frustrated. What is the word term for that called? Affirmation, right? It's saying, I hear you. You sound really frustrated right now. Because if at this point we say, well, looks like you have diabetes to me, or we don't use that term anymore. So that is not really rolling with the patient. It's maybe aggravating the situation more. And I want to let you know, in my experience, most patients don't want to come see us. And that's not because we're not wonderful and great at what we do, but nobody wants diabetes. And so a lot of people, when they come to see me, are really mad. And they'll even tell me later, they'll like, I was prepared to fight you the whole way. or I was just going to sit here and not listen. But after they realize the service we offer and that we're here to help them, and not judge what they're doing, they open up. It's pretty amazing. So I just want to say to all of you, don't take it personal. It's not about you at all. You know, it's about their struggle with having a chronic condition they didn't ask for. Nobody asked for diabetes. It's really difficult to live with. The other thing I think is a helpful tool here is adaptation to the emotional stress of chronic disease. So this is kind of looking at the Kubler-Ross and how it applies to diabetes. Denial. So if a patient, this guy was in denial who came in to see us, we don't agree, but we're going to listen and acknowledge, and we're not going to get complex. We're just going to focus on, hey, You know what? Would you be willing to check your blood sugars? Is that something you would consider doing? Anger indicates awareness. So anger is not bad. Learning begins. Anger is actually, I kind of like it as an emotion. It has a lot of energy and it helps people move forward if they can harness it and move it forward. So don't give the long why answers. Just give clear, concise instruction. Bargaining. Hey, identifies with others. Group classes are good, but this is kind of the person, in my opinion, who says, can I get rid of this diabetes? Want to go away if I eat right and lose weight? Well, probably not, but you can manage it. So let's focus on what the patient wants to know. Depression and frustration. This is when the patient realizes this diabetes isn't going to go away, and this is really hard. And so a lot of times my patients come in and they are working on their diabetes, they're newly diagnosed, they're all amped up and they're losing weight. And then a few years later, they're stuck. I'm sure you've met that. They're just stuck. I just don't want to deal with this anymore. So we really want to make sure we get them support and focus on the changes they have made. And then at some point, most people get to this place if we can coach them and empower them. That is a sense of responsibility for self-care and a sense that, yeah, I could do this. I just had Melanie gave us a cute little quote here. She says, talking about denial, they like being a resident in the valley of denial. Yeah, I mean, I want to say I've had patients in denial for, I don't know, 5 years, 15 years, a long time. They just couldn't get up the nerve to say I have diabetes. So some people are in denial a lot less long, but denial provides us an opportunity to accept. So that's the purpose of denial. It has a great function. It gives us some time. So sometimes if my patients can't accept that fact they have diabetes, I'm like, okay, you don't have to say you have it, but can you check your blood sugars? I mean, I don't exactly say it in that way, but I'm like, can you take your medication, just for now, let's see how it goes. So you don't have to say to somebody, oh, you have to, admit you have diabetes, because it does serve a function. It gives people a chance to get ready for this living with a chronic condition. Okay, I want to talk about diabetes-related emotional distress. Where did I get this from, this information? Well, it's coming out in the literature, and the American Diabetes Association Standards of Care also talk about it. And most of this content I kind of gleaned from the Standards of Care, so you want to be familiar with this. It's called DREAD, diabetes-related emotional distress. These are unique emotional issues directly related to the burdens and worries of living with a chronic disease. A lot of people feel embarrassed and guilty. And I was listening to a really excellent interview with a gentleman who had ALS, and he was saying with ALS, it is a chronic disease, but it causes people around him dis-ease. So you think of the word disease, you could just say dis-ease. And diabetes does cause people dis-ease. It's uncomfortable. They have to check their blood sugar before they eat. They might have to give insulin. They have to say no to birthday cake. It causes a lot of distress for people. More than worry. So it's not just kind of worried about, I don't want to check my blood sugar today. It's bigger than that, but it doesn't reach depression. But it can overlap with depression, anxiety, and stress. It's normal to some extent. Anytime we're dealt a blow, like, oh, you have diabetes, there's going to be distress associated with that. But if it's amplified and it's limiting self-care, then we worry more. And it can be linked to poor health outcomes. So what I've done for you in your resources is I provided you with a diabetes distress scale. And it looks, this diabetes distress scale looks at not only overall distress, but it looks at the emotional burden, physician-related distress, regimen-related distress, and interpersonal distress. So you can have your patients take this distress test, it's hard to say, distress test, and begin a conversation with any item they rate three or more. So three or more says it's a moderate to somewhat serious or more serious problem. 44% of patients report diabetes distress, and only 24% of providers ask patients how diabetes affects their life. So you can take a look, and there's two first questions you can ask people about distress, and the first one is, are you feeling overwhelmed by the demands of living with diabetes? And two, are you feeling that I am failing with my diabetes routine? And if they say those aren't a problem, they're probably, you don't need to do the whole distress scale, but if they rank those as a problem, a three or greater, you're going to want to have them go on and evaluate how their, what their relationship is with their diabetes and how much distress it's causing them. Okay, so here's some other questions. Feeling that diabetes is taking up too much of my mental and physical energy. My doctor doesn't know enough. I'm angry, scared, or depressed. So they rank themselves on these. I'm failing with my diabetes. My friends aren't supportive. Diabetes controls my life. I did meet a gentleman recently who was checking his blood sugars. He's type 2, like 8 times a day, and he said, diabetes is controlling my life. That's diabetes distress. And so maybe before we leave this, what do we do with that? We'll find out where the areas of distress are and then provide appropriate resources or coping skills or helping them set goals that will help them move past this. It just gives us information to identify where their struggles are and what resources that we can share with them or what how we can help them through some behavior change coaching. But we can't fix this. We can listen. We can identify, we can support, and we can refer out, but ultimately, you know, the patient is going to have to really be involved in making the situation better, and they might need some extra support. Okay, you assess that your patient, poll question 4, with newly diagnosed LADA. What is LADA? Well, that's that latent autoimmunity diabetes in adults, and that's, we talked about that in class 1, is struggling with diabetes distress. What is an appropriate intervention? A, encourage them to ask their provider about starting antidepressants. B, set a SMART goal that is very challenging to help them move forward. C, support them in making a small goal. Or D, remind them that alcohol is actually a depressant. So what should we do here? Okay, thanks for voting, everyone. I'm sure you see a lot of distress in your practice. So depression is that very severe situation where distress is in some ways kind of expected, but it can get out of hand too. So we want to identify both and provide resources and some skills. Okay, most of you have voted, so I'm going to close. Oh wait, one more second. Take a vote. Your best choice. Okay, close the poll. Thank you. Let me share this with you. So 9% of you said set a SMART goal that is very challenging to help them move forward. And what is a SMART goal? Well, we're going to find out in a minute. But that would not be an appropriate intervention. I mean, I understand what you're saying, like, let's really help motivate them and get them going, set a goal that's really challenging. But for people in distress, that can be overwhelming and lead to further failure. So when somebody's in distress, we want to see is the right answer, support them in making a small goal that they can achieve. Right now, what is most important is that they have success, that they feel that they can do this, that they can get a handle on this in some small way. So we want to focus on strategies to support them. So I have here strategies to handle diabetes-related distress. For people living with diabetes, this is some suggestions. Take one thing at a time. Take it slowly. Speak up to your healthcare providers and people that understand. Set appropriate goals that are small, achievable, discreet. Healthcare providers, that's us. Same thing. One thing at a time. Take it slowly. Set appropriate goals. Be mindful, mundane, careful about setting goals. Do not overdo it. And we might want to try something like paired glucose testing that doesn't deal with so much the emotions, but gives them a concrete example of success. Like, why don't you just check your blood sugar once a day, and let's check it before you exercise, for example. And let's see, if you check it before you exercise, and then you check it after, what happens to your blood sugar? Do you see that exercise is improving your blood sugar and making a difference? So that might be something very concrete they can do and succeed at that brings them out of that emotional distress and gives them something to do physically. And that can help people move forward too. It depends on the person and it depends on the educator too. We all have different comfort levels of what we suggest and familiarity levels. Let's do another poll question because I said, what is a SMART goal? Let's find out. Which of the following is a SMART goal? A, I will lose 5% of my body weight. B, I will eat less sugary foods throughout the week. C, I will monitor my blood sugar on a regular basis. Or D, I will eat less bag of chips every day for 1 week. Which of the following is a SMART goal? Okay, thank you for voting. Okay, you guys, I am not doing a very good job of tricking you. It's not really tricking you, challenging you, because or maybe you're just like, I get this stuff. It makes sense to me now. Okay, I'm going to close the poll and share it with you. Okay, so what I'm learning from doing these polls is, of course, I'm not really trying to trick you, but I am trying to make these challenging, but that you all are getting ready for this exam. I'm feeling like you're really getting a handle on this content, and when I see your responses, you're just like, you're sure. You're like, this is the right answer. So that's really terrific. So 91% of you chose the right answer, and 10% of you said C. So let's take a look at these and we'll come back. So what is a SMART goal? Are they going to ask you about SMART goals on the exam? Yeah, they are. And I don't know how they're going to ask it, but it'll come up. So a SMART goal is specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and sometimes we say timely or time-bound. So those are the elements of it. So it has to be specific. You have to be able to measure it. You have to be able to achieve it. It has to be relevant to what we're doing. And it has to be time bound. So let's just think about C. Is C smart? It's not really time bound. And it doesn't really give us enough detail. It says, I will monitor my blood sugar on a regular basis. So what does that mean? Is that once a day, twice a day, once a month? And how long are you going to do it for? So all of these other ones are too vague. They don't really drill down to do specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. Except for D, I will eat one last bag of chips every day for 1 week. So it's specific, it's measurable, it's achievable, and it has a time limit, 1 week. And so that's when we meet with our patients, we want to set a SMART goal. And who determines that goal? It's not us, it's them. And so, you know, what I often do at the end of my session, about 15 minutes before we're going to end, I do 1 hour, you know, sessions, individual sessions plus a class, but I say, okay, based on all of what we've talked about today, what one thing would you like to work on as far as changing your behavior? And it's so funny because I often have a really specific goal in mind for them, but they come up with totally something different. I'm always surprised what they come up with. And so it's such a great question to ask because we could say, oh, based on my interview, I think you should work on this. It's not going to work. You have to ask them. Based on this interview and this discussion, what do you think is one thing you would like to work on? And wow, people know what they need to work on. So if we think about mental health, we want to build a foundation. Although the educator might not feel qualified to treat psychological problems, optimizing the patient-educator relationship is a foundation to increase likelihood of acceptance. So just knowing that they're being listened to and acknowledged and that someone out there in the universe cares about them really is a big foundation to help the person take the next step toward emotional health, better emotional health. And key opportunities to screen for emotional health are when patients are newly diagnosed, hospitalized, when the medical status changes. So a lot of times if patients are in crisis, I'm going to really find out what's really going on in your life right now. When complications start and during regular visits. We want to make sure to assess emotional health. And then this again is from the American Diabetes Association. First meeting and regularly. Use instruments like what I've talked about, open-ended questions, ask. And then we want to encourage optimism and resilience. A lot of times when patients tell me their stories of their life, I will bring up and say, wow, you have a lot of resilience. That was really tough and you were able to make it through. Or if they're struggling with weight, I'll ask them, have you ever tried to lose weight before? Oh yeah, I have, and I've lost, 20 pounds. Wow, that's amazing. So you have it in you. You know how to lose weight. So that's encouraging optimism and resilience and, self-confidence. I've done this before. I can do it again. And you know what? This word too, hardiness. You've come through a lot in your life and you've managed to make it through. So I'm feeling really optimistic that you're going to make it through this too. So framing things in a way that I think this is a really important distinction. I'm not going to tell patients, oh, I'm so proud of you, you're so great. It's not about that. It's about really acknowledging what they've accomplished and bringing that to the present and really focusing on behaviors. It's important. Just like what we do with our kids. Okay, indications. Referral to mental health specialists. When would we do that? Gross disregard, depression, stress, self-harm, debilitating anxiety, eating disorder, or poor cognition. Emotional well-being is an important part of diabetes care and self-management. And if we don't identify them and help the patient get the support and resources they need, it can be a real barrier and lead to poor health outcomes. So that's kind of our first section, and now we're going to spend the next half hour on learning and behavior change. And that's where those behavior models come in that you're all anticipating with a great fervor. I would star this slide. So the AADE seven self-care behaviors are important to keep in mind. There's seven of them. How do we know that patients are moving toward better health? Well, we're going to measure, these are core outcome measures: being active, healthy eating, taking medications, monitoring, problem solving, reducing risk, healthy coping. Those are the seven things we measure to evaluate, are we moving towards success? That's behavior change. So we start here with learning. We need to make sure the patient has the knowledge, skills, and we look at the barriers. Then we look at behavior change. After that, we look toward clinical improvement, and then long health is improved. Long term is that improved health status. And so this is a really good slide to be familiar with. It sets a nice framework too for providing diabetes education and care. But let's take a look at Mary. Mary has had diabetes for over 35 years and tells you she knows everything about diabetes. But her doctor insisted she come see you for a check-in with her diabetes. What approach recognizes adult learning theory? Ooh, A1C is 7.3. Adult learning theory. A, share with me how you have been managing your diabetes to achieve an A1C of 7.3. B, can I please see your logbook? C, please demonstrate how you use your meter. Or D, are you meeting your targets 80% of the time? So which one of these, what approach recognizes adult learning theory? All right, thanks for voting. I appreciate it. Actually, most of my case studies are based on real life situations. So it's kind of fun to bring them forward as a little poll question, because this is real life. This happens, this stuff happens all the time. Okay. I'm going to take one more second to vote. Okay. I'm going to close the poll. Let's just share this with all of you. So 82% of you chose the right answer. So adult learning theory says, well, we'll talk about it in a minute, but it really acknowledges the expertise of the person who's been living with diabetes. And A is what I would call curiosity-based questioning. And I do that a lot with my patients, like, oh, wow, your A1C is 7.3. Can you tell me how you've accomplished that? So it's curiosity-based questioning. It's acknowledging their expertise. And what else is it doing? It's giving them a sense of self-confidence, right? Because here the educator who they're worried is going to criticize them is actually acknowledging all their hard work. And that really is part of the construct of adult learning theory. So C, maybe you chose C, please, 18% of you chose that because you're thinking, well, adult learners want to be actively involved. But this, the way it's phrased doesn't really acknowledge their expertise. You know, it's more, what's the word I want to use? It's more, it's like you're inspecting them. But this A more acknowledges their expertise. So if you, like if C said, oh, can you, you've been doing this for so long and you succeeded, can you show Mary how to check her blood sugar? That might be more of adult learning theory, but the way it's phrased here is not. And so that kind of brings me up to another important point is always just use what's in the question. And of course, as I've mentioned before, I'm not an expert question writer, so some of it, you know, I'll take responsibility for. But the general theme here is that adult learners must feel the need to learn. And this is the what's in it for me. Adult learners are like, why should I? How come? What do I do if? And the problem-oriented is, what do I do if? So they don't want just you to regurgitate a bunch of information. You know, I'm going to say, what are you really struggling with your diabetes right now? And they're going to direct me what I should focus on, what to spend my time on, because they have to feel the need to learn. And they learn better when their own experience is used. So we're going to call upon their experience, what they've done, their successes, their challenges, and bring that to the current moment. And they want to actively participate. They just don't want to sit there. They want to show you, participate, touch it, deal, you know, and be involved. Most effective education includes demonstration of skills, practice, or direct practical feedback for efforts. Oh, John, I see that every day at lunch you're not checking your blood sugars. Is that something you want to do? Yeah. Well, how do you think we could do that if it's important to you? What are some of the things that might be stopping you? Or, you know, so that would be, he's problem solving with you. You're actively engaging him. You know you're doing a great job if you're talking less and encouraging people to participate more. And you want to make the behavior real for that patient. You know, realistically, how would you check your blood sugar at lunch? Well, I guess I could bring a meter to work and leave it in my locker. Okay, that's some good problem solving that he came up with, not me. So we want our people to come up with it. Effective diabetes self-management requires behavior change. And we've talked about barriers before, but here they are again. Here's some really serious barriers to change. Income, literacy, poverty, lack of health insurance, or big co-pays, or maybe they're in the donut hole. Competing demands, denial. Maybe they're in the land of denial, distress, lack of knowledge. So we want to really make sure we don't label patients as non-compliant, but really identify what the barriers are. Barriers to learning and behavior change. It's a situation of his or her perception of my attitude. My is the educator and my willingness to understand. So sometimes if the patient feels judged, the door closes and they're not going to engage in a behavior change conversation with us. And I love this quote by Mother Teresa, a place of preaching is not a place of meeting. So again, just a listening from the patient, what's working, what's not working. How can we work around these things? So overcoming barriers, we want to offer patients evidence-based hope messages. You know, John, I know it's been really hard for you to check your blood sugars at lunch, but now, you know, you've been doing it for a week, and I think it's really helping to improve your blood sugars. I've seen now that your blood sugars are more in target. You're checking your blood sugars at lunch, and you're covering with insulin, and that's really improving your day-long blood sugar results. An evidence-based hope message. If we keep that A1C where you have it now, 6.8, we know that we're reducing your risk of complications. So I really want to acknowledge your hard work. Okay, always acknowledging the hard work. Frequent contact. Wow, that's hard for us. We're really busy, but I always get patients' emails and, you know, phone numbers, and I'm saying, email me if you're struggling. Call us. We're here for you. And then, of course, we have a once-a-month support group. Support groups are a really nice way to check in with patients. Here's a great question. Tell me one thing that is driving you crazy about your diabetes. And medication beliefs, those are so big. I had a few patients come in to see me last week whose cholesterol levels were phenomenally elevated. and they said, I do not want to take medications, and I have to honor that. And I have to figure out other strategies to help them get their cholesterol to goal. So of course, I'm going to send them to the dietitian, but I'm going to talk about the importance of nutrition and exercise. And we have to honor this, because sometimes people just don't believe in medications and they might want to try other avenues. That's okay. That's their choice. And if they're motivated, a lot of my patients who don't want medications are so motivated not to go on them, they will make huge behavior changes. I'm sure you've seen that. Impressive. Mindfulness-based interventions. We want to avoid compliance. We want to focus on empowering and acceptance. You are here right now where you're at. Leave yesterday behind. Let's just start from this moment forward. So mindfulness, during our visits with our patients, paying attention on purpose, completely listening to them, non-judgmentally and in the present. And this gives us the opportunity to really hear our clients, because they have really important stuff to share with us. Let's take a look at Joe. Joe is deciding whether or not to start on insulin. His A1C is 9.8%. His mom had diabetes and severe complications due to chronic hyperglycemia. What would best describe application of the health belief model in this situation? A, his level of readiness. B, he is more likely to start insulin if someone he knows is on insulin. C, if he feels empowered to inject insulin. Or D, the benefit and cost associated with insulin injections. What would describe application of the health belief model in this situation? Thanks for voting, everybody. Okay. So on this particular question, I see a lot of, you chose an answer and you moved to a different answer. So I'm really glad I'm asking this. Okay, let's go ahead and close the poll and share with you. Wow, we had a pretty big distribution of answers. So what is the right answer and what is the health belief model? 9% of you said his level of readiness. 18 said he is more likely to start if he knows someone on insulin. C, if he's empowered to inject. Or D, the benefit and costs associated with insulin. So actually, D is the right answer. And so A is the readiness model, and we'll talk about that in a minute, or the trans-theoretical model. B is a social cognitive theory, saying, hey, I'll do it if someone else is doing it. We tend to imitate. C is more looking at the empowerment model, which we're going to be going all over all of these. But the health belief model looks at benefit and costs associated with a particular action. So D is the right answer. So let's go over these models and see what we come up with. So the health belief model says, what is the individual's perceived risk and seriousness of illness? And so if this patient, Joe, thinks, well, gosh, my mom had complications, and if I have diabetes, she had diabetes, she took insulin, I don't know, should I take insulin? Wait, did she take insulin? Let me look. No, it didn't say she took insulin. Okay. But he's saying, my mom, had complications. Should I go on insulin? And he's thinking, maybe if I go on insulin, I might prevent some of the complications my mom had. So if he feels like there's a perceived serious risk, that might encourage him to start insulin. Let's take a look. The more the perceived risk, the more likely to make necessary changes. So how vulnerable does he feel about getting this illness? How serious? The efficacy of behavior in preventing or minimizing the consequences, and the cost or deterrence associated with making the change. What is the cost of injecting insulin? Well, so you need to, people look in this health belief model at the costs and benefits. So just think about, what are the costs? Well, you got to buy the insulin and you have to have syringes. So there's a financial cost, but there's also a cost of time. Now I have to check my blood sugar, I have to get my vial, I have to withdraw the insulin, I have to inject it. And maybe there's a social cost. I don't feel comfortable injecting insulin in front of people, so I have to do it like in the bathroom or, you know, go in this private space and do it. What are the benefits? Well, then he's thinking, what are the benefits? Well, my mom had diabetes, she had complications and she got really sick. Maybe if I go on insulin, it will benefit me. I will have better outcomes. So we have to see how susceptible he feels, how severe he feels the consequence will be, what are the benefits and barriers. And you'll see patients doing this all the time. Well, if I go on insulin, what's going to happen? Oh yeah, and they're worried about weight gain. You might gain some weight, but what's the benefit? You're going to get your A1C down. They're always weighing these two options. And what kind of feeds into this cost-benefit analysis is their feeling of confidence, how well they are going to be able to do something, and then cues to action can also stimulate you to do something. Or like a lot of my patients watch late night TV and there's all those commercials about the complications of the medication. So that actually stops them from wanting to go on medications. Those are cues to action. So health belief is perceived, their vulnerability, and then their perceived susceptibility, severity, what are the benefits, and what is the cost. Now, the next one is a social cognitive theory. This one says patients learn from own and observing others' behaviors and consequences. So let's just say, you know, Mary wants to go to the gym and she knows her girlfriend goes to the gym every day. And since her girlfriend's been going to the gym, she's lost a lot of weight and her clothes fit better and she's a lot more spunkier. So she's learned through social cognition that maybe if I go to the gym, I can look better, feel better, and so forth. So health behavior is constantly changing in the evolving reaction between the person and their environment. So we have to look at the environment, their capability, what they expect from it, what they've learned, and what reinforcement they get from doing the behavior. So this is really social cognitive theory is, depending on your social environment, you're more likely or less likely to do something. Like, what if everybody in your household's always eating junk food? There's only junk food in your house. You're much more likely to eat junk food. It would take a lot of effort for you to say, I'm going to eat healthy foods, salads, what everyone around me is eating junk food. You know, we are our environment. We're surrounded. Our environment really influences us in so many ways. Okay. Let's do another one. Which of the following statements by the educator best reflects using the empowerment approach? We are here to motivate you to get your A1C to target. A motivated patient, B, will always be able to achieve an A1C less than 7%. C, what motivates you to improve your A1C? D, if you follow our suggestions, you will achieve your goals. Let me see. What do you all think is a... Which statement by the educator best reflects using the empowerment approach? All right. Thanks for voting, everybody. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this. So I can tell you all are totally comfortable with the empowerment model. And that's a really important model to be familiar with. 100% of you chose the right answer. We know we cannot motivate anybody. It has to come from the person. We're the coach. We're the cheerleader. We're going to give them tools. But they have got to do the work. And what I put in your handout, your resource page, is a really great sheet I stole right from the Art and Science book that looks at empowerment versus compliance. And it's a really good sheet I would study for the exam. But let me keep talking. Empowerment defined. It helps patients discover and develop their inherent capacity to be responsible for their own lives and gain mastery over their diabetes. Wow. Their inherent capacity. So in order for them to believe that they can do it, they have to feel that we believe. That we believe that they can do it. Choices made by patients, not healthcare professionals, have greatest impact. Patients are in control, and the consequence of self-management decision affects the patients most. It is their right and responsibility to be the primary decision maker. So here's this chart I was talking about, and I would say be really familiar with the difference between traditional, more compliance model, and empowerment-based diabetes self-management education and support. Diabetes is a physical illness would be a traditional approach. Here this says diabetes is a biopsychosocial illness. Bio affecting the physical, psycho, you know, affecting our emotions, and then social, we're affected by the people around us. Wow. Professional is viewed as teacher and problem solver and responsible for outcomes. Empowerment says, well, the patient actually is a problem solver and self-manager, and they get support from the professional with resources. Learning needs are usually identified by the professional. That's traditional. Empowerment says, well, the patient actually identifies those. So you can all take a look at these. But wow, what a great chart to know for the exam. So empowerment-based self-directed behavior change protocol. Define the problem. What part of living with diabetes is most difficult for you? How does it make you feel? And then how would the situation have to change for you to feel better about it? It's all about the person. What barriers? How important is it for you to address this issue? And again, this looks a little bit of health belief. What are the costs and benefits of addressing or not addressing this? So this is a really another way of asking patients questions. So I'm trying to give you a lot of different strategies, wording to really get to help patients make those critical life-saving changes. So empowerment-based self-directed behavior change protocol, identify short-term behavior change experiment, and we want to find out what are some steps you could take to bring you closer to where you want to be, and is there one thing that you will do when you leave to improve things for yourself? So really nailing it down, giving concrete information that the person can say, I'm going to do this when I leave. And then we want to evaluate the plan. So this, a lot of this information came from the Art and Science book, and it has really good information on behavior change in there too. Question 9. A patient tells you that they have been thinking about starting an exercise program. Using the Trans-3 theoretical model, what stage of change are they in? Are they in pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, or maintenance? What do you all think? Okay, thanks for voting. Trans-theoretical model. I was actually at the ADA the year they shared that model. Wow, that was like 15 years ago. It was really exciting. They have good data to support it too. It was cool. I'm so old. I was there for this. Okay. That's how old I am. I am so old that I remember when we used to check. We didn't even have glucose meters. We would check blood sugar using tablets, water, and urine. Okay. I'm going to close this and share with you. So 10% of you chose pre-contemplation, and 90% of you chose contemplation. So if you chose contemplation, that is the right answer. Great job. If you chose pre-contemplation, that's okay. We're going to go over the stages right now so you can become familiar with them. So trans-theoretical theory says, well, the readiness level determines the approach. So if a patient comes in and they're not ready, we can't force it on them. They have to have some degree of readiness. And patients pass through similar stages as they prepare for change. So we know this from research. Simplified version of the stages of change: not ready, no intentions, unsure, and then ready. They just need the know-how. So here's the stages, and I'm going to go over these in more detail with you right now. So here's pre-contemplation. So they're really in the nope, I'm not going to do this stage. So what do? We say, wow, I hear you're really not, let's say this gentleman smokes. I'm here, you're really not ready to quit smoking. You know, you've said that you enjoy smoking, you've been doing it for over 30 years, and you also mentioned that you're worried, you know, you're getting older now. How do you think smoking affects the aging process? You see what I'm saying? That's called raising doubt. So pre-contemplation, I'm not ready, I don't want to do it, we're not going to force them. we're just going to kind of raise doubt about status quo. So that's how we would approach it. And sometimes the patient may say, listen, I just am not ready. Don't even bring this up. Okay, we're going to honor that. And some patients may not even be ready for diabetes education. You know what? That's okay. We're going to give them a hug, a brochure, our card, and say, call me when you're ready. I'm here for you. Maybe you're not ready right now to really deal with this. I understand that. I honor that. Let me know when you're ready because I'm here to help. Wow. You say that to somebody? Guess what? They're going to stay in your office. I don't know. I'm just saying that. But we're acknowledging that. And when you acknowledge people, many times you get a turnaround. Okay. So here's contemplation. That's that person who's getting ready to exercise. Yeah, I'm thinking about exercise. Maybe. They're in the maybe stage. Oh, I hear you're thinking about exercise. Is there anything that, that you could think would really help you to exercise? Well, yeah, my friend's exercising and she looks great. Well, you seem like you have a little ambivalence here. What do you think would be a drawback? Well, I don't really have the right shoes. Okay, so we can start dealing with that. So we want to focus on what's the ambivalence, what might be stopping them, and focus on gains. So the preparation stage says, okay, I want to. I'm ready. So now we need to say, okay, now that you're ready to exercise, let's think about what's realistic for you. So some of my patients will be like, well, I want to start jogging. Okay, well, when's the last time you jogged? Well, 20 years ago when I was in high school. That may not be realistic. So, we want to say, that sounds like a great goal, but you haven't done it for a while. Do you want to just think about starting walking? And then, if you can run, great, but at least walking, you'll kind of get your body warmed up and used to this. And so they need actualizing it. They want to do it. They just need that little tiny gentle push to make it happen. And then we have maintenance, action and maintenance. I'm doing it. I've been doing it for 6 months. And so what we need here is to say, great job. You're doing it, 3 days a week. And we want to find out the details of that. Who, what, where. And then we want to find out, how is that going? Is it anything that could potentially stop you in the future? Because this is really important. You all know this from exercise. You're on a roll, you're exercising, and then the bad weather comes. What are you going to do? And so you want to really acknowledge what they're doing, but you may want to bring up some situations. Oh, you know what? Can you think of any situations that would stop you from going out and roller skateboarding? Well, yeah. It rained the other day and I couldn't skateboard. Okay. What could you do instead? What is your plan B? And then sometimes people just get stuck. Stuck, stuck, stuck. Oops. So maybe what happened is they were on this roll and then they got sick and they stopped exercising and they just haven't got back on the horse again. And so we want to plan for this. And what is your plan if for some reason you stop exercising? Who could you reach out to? What could you do to help get yourself back on track? This is really, really important for people because I work with a lot of patients over a long period of time, and they come and go with their goals. And so when they stop that behavior change, we want to identify what was the barrier and how to help support them in getting back on track. The other thing is when a patient is in this pre-contemplation or contemplation, I'll just let's say contemplation stage. I hear you're thinking, about exercising, or maybe they're ready. You want to say to them, hello, can you all still hear me? Okay. Hang on, just want to make sure you can all hear me. Audio connection. Okay, are you all hearing me okay? But anyways, I had a gentleman come and see me. Okay, nobody's saying they can't hear me. Are you all having any audio problems? Okay, well, I'm going to keep going. Hello? Okay, hang on one second. Okay, nobody's. Okay, am I back? Can you hear me now? So odd, your network connection. Okay, good. Sorry, everyone. For some reason, my connection was lost. So thanks for your patience. We're back again. And so we'll probably go about 5 minutes over. It's 1 o'clock now, just to finish up the... Thank you. Yeah, we're back, right, everybody? Can hear me okay? Lost audio, yes. Okay. Good. I'm feeling like you can all hear me. Yep. Okay, good. So when the patient is in that ready to do it, you want to ask them, how ready are you to lift weights? For example, I had a patient come in and goes, I'm going to start lifting weights. I go, on a scale 1 to 5, how confident are you that you can do that? He's like, oh, it's a 5. Okay, great. So if they're a 3 and they're kind of ambivalent, we want to say, what would help you move to a 4? What would help you move to a 5? What would increase your confidence in that? Because I'm going to tell you why people often choose 3. It's too big of a goal. Like if a patient says, well, I'm going to lift weights 5 days a week. And I'm like, well, how confident are you that you could do that? Oh, about a 3. I'm like, what would make you a 5? You know, what would get you to a 5 in confidence? Well, maybe I could just do it 2 days a week. Okay, bingo. So a lot of times patients make goals that are bigger than are achievable. So that's part of our job too. We want to be cheerleaders and say, great goal, that's awesome. But if it's not realistic for them, they're not going to be able to achieve it. So really, really important to help them set achievable goals. The other thing is exploring ambivalence. For people who say, yeah, I think I'm ready to change, but not quite sure, we want to really explore this with them and find out what are the benefits and what are the cons. This kind of health belief model. What are the disadvantages of keeping the same as what you're doing? And what are the advantages if you change things? And if you just keep doing what you're doing now, where does it leave you? This is a great question. Where does it leave you if you decide not to quit smoking? So we want to summarize ambivalence, begin with reasons for maintaining the status quo, give options, and end with a positive reason for making a change. So I know you've been smoking for a long time. It's really comfortable for you. You know, you enjoy smoking. I'm wondering if you would, you know, consider either cutting back or maybe at least calling this number, 1-800-NO-BUTS. Maybe you just want to find out more about strategies to quit smoking. And you've mentioned that you're kind of worried about the aging process, and certainly if you quit smoking, it's really going to help benefit you as far as your skin and, you know, your energy level. So end with a positive reason for making the change, exploring ambivalence. So we want to find out, as far as breaking barriers, what's really bothering you about your diabetes. Set appropriate goals and be mindful. And when patients are resistant, I have a lot of patients like that. They're angry, they're mad that they're coming in. We want to just listen to them, shift focus and reframe, and really focus on personal choice and control. What change do you feel open to making? Give them the ball and let them take the lead. So instead of pushing back, we're going to say, man, this seems like a really difficult appointment for you. You seem really frustrated right now. Is there any change you'd be open to making right now? And then all of a sudden you've empowered them and given them a little more say in the situation. We talked about relapse. Sometimes patients just aren't able to keep up their behavior change. And that's part of the cycle. It's realistic, acceptable, and to be expected. But as educators, we want to be prepared and talk about a contingency plan. We just don't want to kind of say, oh, they're going to keep doing this and succeed. We really need to be mindful that life cycles through. And if you get off your behavior change, it's okay. We just need a plan and resources. So the motivation to change comes from the patient. Change is ultimately the patient's responsibility. Direct persuasion is usually counterproductive. We all know this. Motivational counseling is quiet and eliciting. So we're going to be good listeners and really find out from the patient, are they ready? We want to support self-confidence, emphasize personal responsibility, and increase a sense of ability to cope. From what you've told me about your past successes, it really seems like you can do this. And that's true for all of you too. Supporting self-confidence as you move in to take this exam, that many of you have taken exams in the past, you've succeeded, you are working hard and studying, and all of your preparation is moving you for readiness. So you are in the ready stage to take this exam, and you are going to do great. I am confident in that, and because you've come to these boot camps, you've listened intently, you've read information, you've taken a million tests, and you are feeling prepared. And I want the voice that speaks to you to be a kind, loving, compassionate voice as you prepare to take this exam. You want to say to yourself, you know, whatever your first name is, Beverly, I'll just use my first name, you've worked really hard to get to this point. I think you're ready for this exam. So other concrete things you can do to succeed is know how to get to your testing site. Get a good night's sleep. Do not stay up late night studying. It's not going to help. You might want to do some flashcards late at night, you know, not late at night, but that night before, do some flashcards to keep your memory fully focused. And then during the test, stand up and move. I really encourage this. Stand up and move. Put your hands on your hips. Take a deep breath. Whatever you need to do. Afterward, celebrate. Treat yourself. I don't care what the result of the exam is. I want you to go out and do something to reward yourself for all your hard work. If you wouldn't mind jotting down your impressions and email us so we can pass it on. And when you pass, send just your photo to post. So we will definitely, as I've mentioned last time, we have a CDE exam success page, and we want to post your photo and your comments there because it's such a wonderful place to go. If you go to that page on our website, you'll see there's people of all ages taking this exam and all different disciplines and succeeding. So that is our hope for you. And whatever the outcome is, remember, it doesn't, I just want to say something really important. With a CDE or without a CDE, you can still be a great educator. So the CDE does not define greatness in diabetes education. It's the compassion and the humanness you bring to each of your encounters with your patients that really make the big difference. So on that note, I'm going to sign off and stay for any additional questions. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.